This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about issues around child welfare in Indiana with Sharon Pierce, who recently announced her retirement as CEO of the Villages of Indiana, a nonprofit child and family services agency. If you have questions or comments on our show today, please let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It is free and easy to use. Just search for the All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by Sharon Pierce, CEO of the Villages of Indiana. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you, Jill, for having me. I'm so excited to have a conversation. And actually, one of the things I love most about child welfare and child well-being is just being able to be a voice for those children and families that we're all so privileged to serve.
It's really important work that you've done for so many years. So thank you. And can you tell people who are out there and maybe don't know, what is the Villages of Indiana? What do you do? And how long have you been there personally?
There are always lots of questions about what is the Villages. Ever since the Villages in Florida, you know, kind of appeared on the map. But the Villages of Indiana is a statewide child welfare agency. Started with the concept of Dr. Carl Menninger, and many folks might know his name. He was an internationally known child psychiatrist who was passionate about the fact that when children were abused or neglected in the 60s and 70s, they were removed from a family situation where there was a great deal of violence often. And at that point in time, they were placed into an institutional setting. And his concern was, how are they ever going to know what it's like to be a part of a family, to be in a normal family setting, and then to be a parent themselves? So he developed a concept called family model group homes in Kansas. And several folks at Lilly Endowment, what would we in Indiana do without Lilly Endowment? We're all so very grateful for them, but loved that concept. And so did a needs assessment in Indiana in the mid 70s about whether or not Indiana needed some additional child and family resources, and decided that in particular in the southern part of Indiana, there were not adequate resources for children who were abused or neglected. So that was really the foundation of the Villages. And we've grown from that family model group home concept to serving 3,100 children every single day, Jill. Wow. But what's exciting to me and to all of us at the Villages is that we're probably very well known for our foster care adoption services. But of those 3,100 children, only 400 are in foster care. And the other 2,700 are being served in their family or in a family, you know, that's supporting them so that indeed they can flourish, they can develop to their full potential. So the Villages today has a full array of services from child abuse prevention. Prevent Child Abuse Indiana actually merged into the Villages in 2006. And so we're the designated chapter of Prevent Child Abuse America in Indiana, to foster care, adoption, family services, kinship care support, and caring for those older youths, partnering with them who are aging out of foster care, weren't adopted by their family of origin, and weren't reunified, you know, with a family, and thus are really a family of one. And so we, through the Villages and with other partner agencies, build a bridge for those young people who've kind of grown up in the child welfare system from childhood to adoption. And we all know, I don't know about you looking back, but I can certainly look back or think about our four children, and you need a really strong bridge in place for that journey.
Yeah.
We love serving those young people as well. So that's quick thumbnail, Jill.
So many ways that you do serve children. And like you said, you know, it isn't just one simple thing. We have to do many things in order to serve children in need in the state of Indiana. So how long have you been with the Villages?
I've been the CEO for 29 years.
Wow.
So almost 30 years.
Congratulations.
And, you mentioned in your intro, announced that in late October, I announced that I felt, you know, that it was time for a new leader at the Villages. And so we don't have a date drawn in the sand. I just want the transition team, and we have a phenomenal board-led transition team, to find somebody that loves the Villages, loves the staff, loves the mission as much as I do. And that's exactly what they're looking for.
Was there any other reasons? You know, now is a good time to retire. Any other reasons behind your retirement?
You know, not really. I will be 73 in March, and I think that was the biggest reason. All of my friends are long retired, and we have 4 grown children, all of whom are married, 7 grandchildren, and I love spending time with them. I'm a kid person through and through, but I also know that our grandchildren pretty soon will, you know, they're kind of in an age range from 6 to 12, and pretty soon their own friends are going to be much more important than Nana and Poppy, my husband and I are. And so want to make sure that I can support our family and have some time with those grandchildren. And literally, as a person of faith, I've prayed not to stay too long, because I think in the nonprofit sector, it's so critical to be able to give 150% to that mission that you're so privileged to be a part of. So those were really the reasons.
It does take a commitment and a passion, and it's extremely important. Can you tell us, you know, how you first were interested in this line of work, and how it has always spoken to you?
Yeah, I love to share that story. I'm a native of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grew up there with a mom, a dad, and 3 brothers. And my mother was very much a servant leader, a community service person. And so she was a very active volunteer at an institution called Saulwood Youth Home. And it was a program in Allen County, the Fort Wayne area, that served young men who had juvenile delinquency as a part of their life situation. And so my brothers and I would go every holiday, Halloween, Valentine's Day, Christmas, Easter, and do holiday parties for them. And it struck me so quickly. I'm the oldest in our family. And it really struck me that these young men are just like my 3 brothers. They just don't have the mom and dad that we have. And I think that was my call to social work, was to realize that you could make a difference. And I saw how much those young men just loved a normal experience, you know, celebrating a holiday. And that's been one of my passions at the Villages, and in all my work in child welfare over the years, is making sure that we are providing not just opportunities for those children to heal from the trauma of child abuse and neglect that they might have experienced, but to know what it's like to be a part of a kid, you know. And it's a huge worry, I'm sure, for all of us and all of your listeners, as we face, you know, almost 12 full months now of this pandemic, that so many children are losing a year of their childhood. But for the kids that we work with, that's even more true. So we work really hard at the Villages to create as many normalizing opportunities as possible, letting them know that, you know, life goals are critical, but fun and relationships are equally important to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people, you know, automatically think of the state when they hear child welfare, but your group is a nonprofit. There are a lot of different groups and people involved in the system here in Indiana. Can you get a sense of the larger picture?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's been, as long as I've been in child welfare, which is nearing on about 50 years now, it's been an enigma to me that when people think about child welfare, they think only of the state child welfare agency. And certainly in our state and in neighboring states, the state child welfare agency for us, Department of Child Services, plays such a critical role. There's no doubt about that. But it's a tapestry, really, of the public sector, DCS, the private sector, agencies like the Villages and our colleagues throughout the state, juvenile court judges, court-appointed special advocates, those CASAs that are often the children's voice in court, foster parents, adoptive parents, grandparents and kinship caregivers, relatives who are standing in the gap to raise children whose parents simply aren't able to. All of us make up the child welfare system. And so every year about this time when the General Assembly is starting, there are a number of us that really do all we can to help remind our policymakers that as you make decisions, don't think only about that state child welfare agency, but also think about the private sector and our many, many partners that are so critical to child and family well-being. And certainly our educators, our teachers, our education system are key partners as well. So, you know, and I love to think about child well-being. I think we're trying in more recent years to reframe child abuse and neglect to more of a prevention focus in child well-being. And, you know, you mentioned in your introduction, the Federal Families First Prevention Services Act, and that's a federal piece of legislation that is really insisting, if you will, that every state and every state child welfare agency, if they're going to get that funding that the federal government provides, must demonstrate each and every year a stronger commitment to actually preventing child abuse and neglect from ever occurring.
Yeah, I've seen a real move towards that in recent years as well. Do you think there's still misconceptions, though, when people do think and talk about child welfare and how the whole process works?
I do, because it's a complex process. And I think oftentimes we in the public tend to point a finger at a parent when perhaps that parent was harmed, maltreated themselves as a child, has no support system, simply doesn't have the capacity to be the kind of parent that they want to be. So that's what I love about the Families First Prevention Services Act, is it's really emphasizing a much stronger partnership, not just with the community and private providers like the Villages of Indiana, but with the families themselves, who really know their child better than almost anyone, if not, you know, everyone.
Yeah, we do want to get into that, you know, talking about that piece of federal legislation that hopefully will really, you know, change systems and impact things that are happening in the child welfare system. We do want to get a little more of your history as well and the history here in the state of Indiana, because it's so interesting. So we will be back shortly with our guest after a quick break. We're talking with Sharon Pierce about the child welfare system here in Indiana. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. We're live today. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. We're talking today about child welfare with Sharon Pierce, who recently announced her retirement as CEO of the Villages of Indiana, a nonprofit child and family services agency. Pierce has worked for decades around issues of child welfare. We would love your questions or comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We're joined by Sharon Pierce, CEO of the Villages of Indiana. Thanks, Sharon. And I do want to say from our colleague here, I did get an email, so appreciate the program on Sharon. That's from Gail Strong, so I thought you'd appreciate that.
Best, isn't she?
Truly.
She's one of the many rock stars in our community.
Truly. So talking again about your long, long career, and, you know, you've worked in the private sector and the public sector, the private and the public sector, and for a while at the Family and Social Services Administration, or the FSSA, here in Indiana. Can you tell us a little bit about the work you did there?
Sure. And, you know, it's such a great education, I think, to work for the public sector, to learn about federal funding streams, to learn how the sausage is made, if you will, as we often talk about legislation, to get to know legislators. And, you know, Indiana has a lot of richness in terms of legislators who have served us for many, many years. So I feel like those years when I was the deputy director of the Division of Family and Children, as it was called then, and oversaw the child welfare system, it was just a great education for me and a great opportunity to explore the entire state. At that point in time, child welfare was still county supervised and administered. So we had 92 different county systems. Property taxes were the primary funding source for child and family services. And, you know, it was a little easier, I think, when it's a county administered system to meet the unique needs of a county. Certainly, there are always advantages, and we had no choice probably as a state, but to really begin to streamline and kind of centralize core services, not only child welfare, but mental health and other services. But you always want to keep in mind how we can stay in touch with those grassroots needs. You know, Indiana is over 80% rural, and those needs are so different than our urban centers. And I think all of us really throughout the pandemic, Jill, have learned a lot about accessibility by having to move to more virtual services. And so, but those were great years. We had 92 county directors of the Division of Family and Children, and they had the responsibility for overseeing child welfare as well as TANF and all of the federal supports. So
what year years were those? Sorry.
That was kind of the 90-92 time. Evan Bayh was the governor at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And it was really when FSSA had, you know, coalesced to kind of oversee all of the health and human services organizations. So it was a time of a lot of change, but a lot of energy, too.
Yeah. What was some of that energy? What was it like getting things done at the state level back then?
Well, you know, one of the things we realized quickly was that with 92 counties, we did not have an integrated way to report child abuse and neglect and track it. It was easier to track a stolen car than it was an abused child. And that was pretty traumatic when we all realized that. So one of the things we began to work on was putting in place the 1-800 number where citizens are able to report child abuse and neglect. It was also a time when there was an introduction to working with first-time parents. And that program called the Healthy Families Program was started in Hawaii. I always volunteered to go visit, you know, and have a hands-on experience. Didn't get to do that, but learned a lot from that program model. And as you probably know, we now have that Healthy Families Indiana program based on that model in all 92 counties. And I love that program. The Villages is one of the largest providers of that program because it reaches out in a voluntary way to first-time parents and says, would you like help in the most difficult job you're ever going to have? You know, it's always amazed me that we can get help from how to make stir fry and what color we should wear and, you know, what exercises we should do. But it's not, for some reason, socially acceptable to ask about the most difficult job that any of us will ever do. And the most important, being a parent. So the Healthy Families Program really embraces first-time parents and helps them better understand child development, supports them in this critical role, and more recently even helps them begin to achieve their dreams. I know we've recently gotten a United Way of Central Indiana grant, which we're very excited about, to help complement the child development and parent support components of Healthy Families with some economic and educational self-sufficiency focus. So really getting young families, new families started off on the right foot. So those were really exciting opportunities at that point in time. And I think that was also an era when the National Governors Association and groups like the National Conference on State Legislature started talking with one another, one state to another, about how do you best do this work? So I see that as kind of the beginning of the dialogue around what is the best practice in child and family service programs? What are the best practices in child welfare and child well-being? So very much on the ground floor of watching that commitment to best practice grow, not just in our state, but in neighboring states. I had worked in child welfare for a number of years in Illinois when my husband had a couple job transfers there. And so it provided that petri dish, if you will, of learning about best practices for child and family services.
Like you said, I mean, so much of it is that education and awareness component. And if you can get that to young parents, for instance, I mean, it can make all the difference in the world.
Absolutely.
Anything that you remember about the challenges and the benefits of, you know, being the director of child welfare here in the state of Indiana?
Well, it's very much a darned if you do and darned if you don't experience. And I can remember one of my beloved staff members brought me a picture, and it had a gentleman hanging from a noose, and it said he removed a child from their family. And another gentleman hanging right next to him from a noose saying he didn't. And so you always have that dichotomy of opinion, of concern around, is there something we could have done to keep this child safe, to rehabilitate very, very quickly in the interest of safety for children, this family? And so that's a tension, I think, that's still present today, very honestly, yeah. Jill. And you know, we really count on our frontline workers, both within the Department of Child Services and agencies like the Villages, to be on top of their assessment and investigative skills. And yet what they really went to school for was the relational skills of building bridges with children, youth, and families. So that's a tension that I think is just always there. It's a lot like our first responders and our law enforcement, you know, folks. They, when you hear interviews, you know, in the media, they are always talking about, I wanted to do this to help people. That's what draws all of us to child welfare. And sometimes you feel like separating a child from their family, even if it's a less than ideal situation, is that the right thing for them? So so I think that that's a challenge that always, you know, it's the yin and the yang of this work, very honestly.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly the State Department of Child Services still faces many issues, and we hope to be able to get into, you know, a little bit of that as well. But we actually have a voicemail from a listener, Katie, with a question about the Indiana State Department of Child Services. So if we could go ahead and listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Katie, and I'm calling from Lafayette. I've been at CASA for 15 years, and I studied child welfare as a graduate student at Purdue. Curious about, it seems that historically, legislation has kind of wavered between whether it's in the best interest of the children to be reunited with family, or there have been times I know in the past where adoption has been sort of more the rhetoric, you know, get them away from the welfare mom, and some of that rhetoric we heard in, you know, the 80s and 90s. And I just wondered, does the Indiana State Department of Child Services have a preference at this point? Is the research saying it's better to always reunite with children, or on a case-by-case basis, is it sometimes best that they seek another home for the children? Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, so much. She said she was a CASA worker, which, as you mentioned, you know, those court-appointed advocates that are so important as part of this larger system. I would imagine that, you know, you still interact with many people in the state. And that's one of those things that you were mentioning that, you know, can change from time to time. Is reunification still the goal? How do we, you know, best decide what's best in every case, and what's that looking like today?
And, you know, I thank Katie, too, for her question. And the reality is, what we've learned over the years is there is no single silver bullet. And sometimes human services makes the mistake of thinking there is. So as Katie alluded to, there was an era where family preservation was first and foremost, you know, keeping families together. There was a time frame, particularly in the crack cocaine concerns in the 80s, where it was separating the child from the families. And I think what we are learning, and I certainly don't officially speak for the Department of Child Services, but as I think about the culture in Indiana, we are trying child by child to be case specific about what this child needs, what their family needs in terms of support. Can the child still be safe in that child setting, in that family setting? And if so, what are the supports that we need to put in place? Oftentimes, the parent themselves will decide, you know, make that really, really difficult decision that I just don't know that I'm equipped to be a parent and want their child to have what we call a forever family in the adoption world. So it's not an either or at this point, Jill. It is what is in the best interest of this particular child and this particular family. But I think we are making a much more concerted effort, not just in Indiana, but nationally. And the federal government, the Department of Health and Human Services, is really helping to lead this charge that let's start helping to support these biological families in the same way we often support our foster and adoptive families, so that if we can keep children within their family of origin, we're able to do that. Because there is research over the years that shows that oftentimes that is in the better interest of the child. But again, it's not an either or. It's always a case specific situation.
And oftentimes families, yes, are simply dealing with, you know, issues like poverty and other factors that play into, you know, why or why not they may not be able to, you know, give their child the greatest well-being. And I know you mentioned, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, but as recently as a couple years ago, the state also was dealing with that issue in response to the opioid epidemic. We definitely heard that.
Absolutely. And we doubled the number of foster children that we were serving in any given year, you know, just on a treadmill, recruiting and training and screening and supporting foster parents to try to stand in the gap in hopes that those parents could step away. You know, we all know that addiction isn't a choice, it's an illness. And I am so proud of what Indiana has done over the years to beef up the supports, the treatment initiatives that we have in place for adults who are struggling with addictions, and particularly those parents, because it is heart-wrenching. And 9 times out of 10, those children want to be with their own parent, if they possibly can. But that was a difficult time. And very honestly, we're seeing a little resurgence of the opioid crisis with the pandemic stretching as long as it has. These last 4 to 6 months, we've seen a return to increase, sadly, in the opioid use. And I think the hopelessness that a lot of folks feel and the economic challenges, you know, sometimes add to the propensity for a substance abuse disorder. So again, I hope all of us will be encouraging our legislators to continue investing in treatment for substance abuse, because you can and do recover, just like we know young children can and do recover from the trauma of child abuse and neglect. But it's just like a medical situation. You need to have the right services at the right time and for the right length of time to get well.
Yeah, we'll be actually talking about that issue this week as well. So we are having a comment from Lamont on Facebook, who says, Sharon Pierce, thank you for all you do for kids and families. Congratulations on your retirement. If Indiana, our people, organizations, and systems could do one thing to honor your service by ensuring the welfare and success of young people, what would that be?
You know, I think reaching out to the children in our lives, just think if every listener did that and made sure that the children in our lives, you know, they may be our children, they may be our grandchildren, nieces or nephews, they may be children who are in our grandchildren's classroom that don't have the opportunities to build some additional support so that they can have a brighter future. I think we'd see so many more young people reaching their full potential. And I think over the years, Jill, one of the other things we have really realized that we've neglected in human services is the engagement of fathers. So many of our services are so mother focused, and children are yearning for their fathers. They're yearning for that relationship. And so I get excited about Dad's Inc. is a small nonprofit that has also merged into the Villages. And we love those father engagement programs. And those fathers get so excited when they can bring smiles to the face of their children. So those are a couple of thoughts that come to mind. Again, there's no silver bullet, but I think realizing that children are the only future our state has. So we want them to be healthy. We want them to be educated. We want them to be nurtured and nourished. Food security is another issue. So, you know, we could talk for two 2 hours about this.
Easy. Another issue, you know, is funding. Certainly, you know, a lot of this cannot get done without proper funding. Is there enough money going towards child welfare from the state?
You know, I just finished a call with the new CFO of the Department of Child Services, Erin Atwell, who came from the state budget agency. And it made me proud of our state that we all know these are difficult times right now. Every state agency was asked to cut by 15% their budget proposed for the coming 2 years versus the past biennium. And yet the state budget agency, Department of Child Services, and, you know, some of the policymakers realized we can't do that to the Department of Child Services budget. And in Indiana, our DCS budget has two components. There's an administrative component to that budget, which funds the Department of Child Services, case managers, and all of their services. And then there's a family and children fund, which invests in the service providers like the villages and all of our colleagues throughout the state. So the former dollars that were coming from county property tax dollars to pay for the services, you know, are that family and children fund. And they've made the difficult decision in these difficult times that indeed we cannot cut 15% from the child and family services budget. So we're looking at probably between a 4% and 5% reduction, which will mean, you know, tightening all of our belts. Yeah. And we all love to think that there could be more resources. But I also always feel like we need to be realistic. And just as we ask our own family in difficult times to make some sacrifices, we need to do that too.
Yeah. We're joined today by Sharon Pierce, and we will return with her. She's the retiring CEO of the Villages of Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back now to our discussion on child welfare in Indiana. We would love to hear your questions or comments on the topic. Find us at Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. And again, Sharon Pierce, CEO of the Villages of Indiana, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking, Jill, something we haven't touched on is the need for foster families throughout the state. And, you know, people often say, well, I'm just not in a place where I could be a foster parent. And we certainly understand that. But there are so many great ways that we can support those who can step up and be a foster parent. I know we do a couple times a year, we'll do a hashtag diaper day drive, particularly for those foster parents. And about 50% of the children who come into the foster care system are five and under, and many of them have not had the experience of being potty trained yet. So we all know diapers are a huge expense. And for some families, it's diapers or dinner, you know, and that's a good place to be. But would just encourage everyone to, if they're feeling called to be a foster parent, we have got a great website and lots of information, villageskids.org. And I know DCS also has great information about foster parents. But to know that if you can't open your heart and your home right now, that there are other ways to support them. Faith communities are starting to really step forward and have maybe a meal once a month where foster parents could have that meal fixed and there's an activity for the children. Obviously, COVID has made that a bit different, but folks are finding safe ways to support others in their community. And that's something that we can do all across the state.
Yeah, I've spent some time at, you know, at the State House when foster parents do come together. And it's just so powerful to see how many people are willing to step in and be that person in a child's life. Of course, you know, lawmakers back to work this month. And you have have talked to a few lawmakers in your career. What are some pieces of state legislation around child welfare that have been, you know, especially important and impactful for kids and families in Indiana?
You know, I think as we've tried to particularly look for those to those young people who are status offenders or who are breaking the law, and realizing that oftentimes it's a lack of supervision, it's a lack of role modeling, and so kind of what I call decriminalizing some of those offenses and working with those young people so that indeed we find out what are the gifts, what are the things that they enjoy, and rather than seeing a young person spend a lot of time in a detention center or a correctional facility, getting back into their classroom, back in the community, maybe on a team or in a band or an orchestra or a choir, and really being able to be a young person. I get so excited when I see those kinds of opportunities. I'm excited because many of you know Representative Vanessa Summers, who's been just a huge champion for kinship caregivers, those mm-hmm. grandparents in particular, but relatives who are raising their grandchildren. And that group of caregivers really emerged during the opioid crisis as a group who deserve and need our support. And so we've looked at things recently like putting the guardianship form on the Indiana Court Access website. We're looking right now at, do other states waive the filing fees for guardianship or adoption for these kinship caregivers? Because so many times they are dipping into their own retirement resources. So anything that can help children be a part of a family circle that they're connected to is the kind of legislation that I love to see. There is some interesting legislation this year being proposed around transparency and funding, and allowing all of us to better understand what are the funding streams that go into child welfare and child and family services. And I think that's really an important piece of legislation as well, because I don't think it has a number assigned yet, but as taxpayers and investors and in partners, it's hard for us to suggest what we think might be a potential better way if we don't have all the facts. So I think those kinds of things are good, really enabling us as taxpayers and partners in child and family services to be true partners with the state.
Mm-hmm. Is there any you know, pieces of legislation that you had worked on over your career or supported that, you know, didn't happen for some reason or another?
You know, I can't think of anything. When I think of one of the ones that I was most excited about, it was actually at the federal level with the Families First Prevention Services mm-hmm. Act. And Indiana was what we call a Title IV-E waiver state. We had a waiver to do some unique things with the federal funding stream that primarily funds child welfare, called Title IV-E. And when on Capitol Hill, they passed the Families First Prevention Services Act, they didn't allow enough time. The on-ramp, as I used to say, was so short that it made it impossible for states like Indiana and Illinois, Ohio. We all had 4E waivers. So several of us worked together and actually did a congressional briefing on Capitol Hill. And I just, at the last minute, happened to think about taking some pictures of some of the children that were privileged to serve at the Villages. You know, they were obviously adopted children, so I could have the permission to do that, or children in kinship care. And I shared those pictures and was able to talk about how critical this transition timeframe was for states like Indiana. And Representative Jackie Walorski from Northern Indiana, mm-hmm. and then Representative Danny Davis, a Democrat across the aisle from Illinois, introduced transition funding for the Families First Prevention Services Act. And so that's one of those moments when you think, oh my gosh, that was so exciting to be a part of that, and to think that that helped not just our state, but also other neighboring states. There were actually 14 states that were impacted by that, and allowed us as Indiana to better prepare for this new, literally transformational legislation.
So talk about that, the Families First Prevention Services sure. Act. This is new legislation. And, you know, as you mentioned, a greater push towards prevention is really something that most parties can agree is necessary.
A push towards prevention, and also an emphasis on what I call lived experience. Mm-hmm. Hearing from the voices of a youth who's grown up in foster care, hearing from a biological mother who would have given anything to be able to turn the corner and be the kind of parent that her children needed, hearing from grandparents who are raising their grandchildren. And Director Stignan is doing a great job of this. She has a number of councils and voices that she's already listening to. We do a lot of this at the Villages. We have a former foster youth who's now on our corporate board. And, you know, that lived experience, and it goes even further to me, lived expertise, if you will. Who knows better what we can do to enhance these child and family service systems than those who have been impacted by them? So as exciting as it is to go to, you know, expecting states to fund more early intervention and prevention services, I think it's equally exciting to give greater voice to those that the system was designed to serve. And this is going to be transformational, and it's not going to happen overnight. Indiana has committed as a state that as of September 29th, 2021, we will be enacting the expectations of the Families First Prevention Services Act. They allowed for, again, through that Families First transition bill, a three-year period for preparation. And we decided to take the maximum preparation time, which I think was really wise, because we had some dedicated funding that we won't have. And so we want to make sure we've got all of our ducks in a row to serve families more fully, and also to make sure that all counties in Indiana have access to the kind of array of services that folks in central Indiana or in Fort Wayne or Gary, Evansville, our larger cities have. You know, we don't want geography to determine what kind of fate a family will experience. We want there to be equal accessibility. Does that answer your question, Jill?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of elements that will go into change with this act in Indiana. You make me think of Joshua Christian, who is a foster youth advocate from here in Indiana, who's working on the federal level, and how, you know, his input could really shift policy. It's interesting.
Right. Absolutely.
So you've obviously worked in the public and private sectors in this field, and we know it's so important to have, you know, all stakeholders on board. But how do these two worlds interact? Are they interacting well here in Indiana, in your experience?
I think, and particularly as COVID started to impact the child welfare system, the communication just increased phenomenally. There for a while, March, April, May, June, we were having weekly calls with the Department of Child Services. Now they're biweekly, but still very informational. The state association that supports agencies like the Villages of Indiana, IARCA, Indiana Association of Resources and Child Advocacy, also has a twice a month call. And so I really feel like I'm one to always look for the silver linings. And as traumatic as the pandemic has been, and as tragic as all of the loss of life has been, not just in our state, but nationally, I think we have to really pay attention to the lessons learned. And, you know, one of those big lessons is the system is stronger when we are working as full partners. And I feel like that is really happening. And I see Department of Child Services, FSSA, and the State Department of Health also working much more closely together. And I think this year, with the focus on education funding in the General Assembly, there will be also, you know, a bringing in, if you will, of the Department of Education, so that we can look at how can collectively we enhance the opportunities, whether it's for e-learning or catching up those vulnerable children that agencies like the Villages have been working with throughout this pandemic, that we had to go in and provide the hotspots. We had donors that worked with us to help provide iPads. We have tutoring on Zoom once a week for some of the children in kinship care whose grandparents simply don't feel comfortable educating them. So I do feel that, you know, we bring different perspectives, but our goal is the same, to do all we can to best support the vulnerable children, youth, and families in the state of Indiana.
Now, you mentioned, you know, the current DCS director, Terry Stignan, who took over a few years ago after former DCS director Mary Beth Bonifacio resigned. And when she did resign, she wrote a letter to the governor, and it she was very critical of the administration and saying, you know, that children's lives were at risk. And again, we talked briefly about, you know, the opioid epidemic at the time and the large number of children that were entering the system. Do you feel that we're in a better place now?
I do. And I think I've worked for many, many years with the Honorable Judge Bonaventura, and she was very genuine in her concerns. And that was the perfect storm of a time, if you will, with the opioid crisis and the economic challenges that we were starting to face. And so I think that much of her concerns were listened to. And I think Director Stignan is a wonderful listener. And, you know, I use the medical analogy a lot in child welfare. It really is like getting the medicine you need quickly when you need it. And we know that's what the COVID vaccine is about, right? Is that prevention. So that's what's exciting to me and been exciting this last decade or so, to see the system moving to supporting all families, acknowledging that, you know, I joke about, I could have used the Healthy Families Program. My mother passed away at a very young age, and we had twins that were 3 months premature. Mm. So one came home from the hospital 40 years ago, weighing, you know, 5 pounds after 3 months, and one went down to 114 at one point. I could have used the Healthy Families Program.
Wow.
So wouldn't it be neat to think we could get to a point where we had universal support for parents, and that those services are voluntarily available to anyone who needs it? You know, that's the kind of safety net that I'd love to see in the future for kids and families. Again, acknowledging that being a parent is the most important job any of us who are parents will ever assume. And it's also the most difficult.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, with that in mind, you know, obviously, that's a really important thing to want to have happen. What do you think is critical here, with the limited time that we have left, to happen here in Indiana in the next few years? What would you like to see us really focus on to address issues around child welfare?
You know, I think making sure that partnership that has been strengthened with COVID between the public and private sector continues to be strong, continues to be have equal voice, if you will, talking with legislators, having some champions in the General Assembly who understand how critical services to children and families are, and that it's not about bad parents. It's about providing the support and modeling that all parents need. And then making this a priority, you know, in terms of our funding, whether that's through Department of Child Services, Department of Education, you know, our mental health needs. I think certainly being more attentive to the mental health needs of children and adults of all ages is really critical. And removing the stigma of reaching out to ask for help as a parent, or reaching out to ask for help as someone who needs some support in their emotional well-being. I would love, that would be my utopia.
Definitely something I feel like we saw some movement around with the addiction crisis. And now possibly even more movement and acceptance with the pandemic.
I agree. Yeah. Again, another silver lining. And our own Indianapolis Colts are committing to, you know, removing the stigma. So when we bring corporate voices, I guess that's the other vision, Jill. When the corporate America and corporate Indiana gets engaged in child well-being, that's when we'll get some real listening at the State House.
Yeah. And certainly, like you said, it does take us all. It takes a village.
It does indeed.
Well, Sharon Pierce, I just want to thank you so much and say congratulations on such a long career. I know you're not stepping out the door yet, but thank you so much for joining us today and talking about this really important issue.
You are welcome. And thanks for allowing us to be the voice of those kids and families. That's one of our critical roles. So it's a privilege each and every day.
Thank you. Sharon Pierce is CEO of the Villages of Indiana. We really appreciate your time today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a live conversation on issues around substance abuse in Indiana. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.